It was to be the adventure of a lifetime, scaling the highest mountain in the world.
Well, the takeaway from Everest turned out to be not at all what I expected.
There are people climbing Everest today who should not be climbing Mount Everest.
I've tried a lot of hobbies. Now, I'm on the hunt for my next hobby, some common, some not so much. This week...
Drained of all energy and frostbitten, the climbers had to fight for their lives.
Climbing Everest.
It's magical, and I never regret it.
You're listening to That's a Hobby. This episode is obviously a little bit different. When I learn about a hobby, I actually set out to try it. But that's just not going to happen with climbing Everest. After reading Into Thin Air, probably the most popular account of climbing Mount Everest, I had to learn more about it and the people who do it. Think of this episode kind of as a book report. Even though this is a hobby I'm definitely not going to try, I'm still pretty drawn to it for the same reasons I'm drawn to the Spartan race and racing cars and stand-up comedy. I'm drawn to the physical and mental aspects of it, the challenges. Everest is a location in the world that everyone knows about. As a kid, after seeing my first mountain in Iran, I remember thinking, I wonder what the tallest mountain is. And my next thought was, I wonder if anyone has climbed it. I remember looking up Everest in the E volume of the encyclopedia in our school library for a project. I remember looking up Everest on Encyclopedia Britannica on our first IBM in 1997 to see pictures. This was in the 90s, and Everest was pretty hot back then. What led me to this episode, as I said, was finally reading the book Into the Thin Air by John Krakauer, which is a personal account of climbing Everest and the disasters that are inevitable. After the 90s, Everest's reputation changed a bit as more people climbed it. It started to lose its mystique and sense of danger. With enough money and a bit of training, it seemed like anyone could do it. There were pictures of long lines of climbers holding on a rope, leading them exactly where they needed to go. There were pictures of all the garbage left by the adventure tourists. I kinda didn't see Everest as I did when I was in school. That is, until I read Into Thin Air. So, to the book report. First, let's learn about Everest. Everest is obviously the world's tallest mountain. The official height, or the elevation from sea level, is about 8,848 meters, almost 9 kilometers up. It borders Nepal and China, or Tibet. It got its English or common name in 1865 by the Brits, named after surveyor Sir George Everest. Otherwise, it's known as Sagarmatha in Nepali, or Chomo Lungma in Tibetan. There are two main routes to the top, or summit. There's the standard route, which is the south side through Nepal, and the north route through Tibet or China. The first recorded successful climb, meaning they made it to the summit and back down, was in 1953 by the British team of Edmund Hillary and Tenzing Norgay, a Nepali Sherpa. By 1987, 200 had successfully summited Everest. After the rapid commercialization of the 90s, that number shot up to 4,042 by March 2012, with an actually pretty low death count of 223. That's basically 5%. And a third of those deaths are estimated to be Sherpas. Let's talk about Sherpas. Most people know Sherpas to be mountain people who carry things to help the climbers. They're both respected and also kind of seen as exploited. Sherpa people are indigenous to the mountains of Nepal and the Himalayas. The word Sherpa roughly translates to the East people. In 2011, the Nepali census estimated almost 500,000 Sherpas lived in Nepal. Because they live in the mountains for generations, they are elite mountaineers and guides. They are also physically acclimated to the conditions, which we'll get to. So, are Sherpas exploited? Sherpas are indispensable to the 4,000 plus people who've made it to the top of Everest, and the commercialization of the mountain would have been impossible. Sherpas serve a few critical functions. One, they create and clear the path ahead of the climbers. Two, they carry the majority of the gear, including the really important oxygen tanks, up to the many campsites so the other climbers can preserve their energy. And three, they provide climbing expertise. Being a Sherpa is actually a significant benefit to their families and community. With the annual income in Nepal being about $700 a year, a Sherpa can make 8 times that. All told, climbing Everest brings in nearly $300 million a year to Nepal. Even though climbing Everest is dangerous, it doesn't mean the alternatives are any less dangerous, and they certainly wouldn't pay anywhere near the same amount. So, how do you even climb Everest? Let's start with the cost. It can cost from $40,000 to $80,000 to $150,000 to climb Everest, depending on if you're climbing from the Nepal side or the Tibetan side, and the type of support you need.
He mentioned $70,000. This whole trip is becoming a status symbol, isn't it?
The rules are constantly changing, like climbers need to be escorted by one guide minimum, meaning you'd pay for that one guide instead of a team sharing guides. And there are fees, a lot of fees. There are the garbage collection fees, security deposits, permits, yak fees, transportation to base camp, insurance, all the gear you need to buy, and lodging fees. Oh, and don't forget the cost of taking 2 months off work and getting to Nepal or Tibet.
Why do people do this?
I was pretty surprised too when I learned it takes 2 months. Why does it take 2 months? Well, it takes about a week or more to get to base camp. And then the majority of the time is actually climbing to the different campsites, acclimating, and then finally the summit. And when you're done, it takes about a week to get home. The acclimation period is basically going to the different elevations and staying for a day or two and then going back down. This is done a few times until the body adjusts to the high altitude. And this is the main danger of climbing Everest, the high altitude. The higher you go, the less oxygen. The less oxygen, the slower you are and the harder it is to think. It is such a big hurdle that 90% of climbers get sick just making it to base camp. The main illnesses have to do with this lack of oxygen and adapting to the food. Food illnesses are especially dangerous since they lead to dehydration and weakness, which are obviously a deadly combination.
Because you didn't want to slide away into unconsciousness, because the odds would be you'd never wake up again.
The lack of oxygen is pretty terrifying. It leads to physically deteriorating, or rotting, as one scientist called it. Your brain swells and that causes dizziness. And there's debilitating headaches, trouble sleeping, loss of appetite, and nausea. And it gets much worse. This can lead to high-altitude cerebral edema, which is described as your brain swelling so much, its only path is to exit your skull through your spinal column.
Good heavens, Michael, I mean, is it really worth it?
This makes people look like they're drunk, they're confused, they slur their speech, they hallucinate, they vomit, and they have impaired judgment. Judgment that can easily lead to going down the wrong way off a cliff.
He said he had gotten lost up on the mountain in the whiteout, lost all his energy, collapsed in the snow, and laid there. He was aware the climbers were coming by him, but he was totally powerless to even make a move. He couldn't even signal that he was still alive.
It can also lead to high-altitude pulmonary edema, which is the accumulation of fluid in the lungs. This leads to coughing, trouble breathing, and severe weakness. This is even more extreme in what's called the death zone, which is above the 8,000-meter mark. Here, just sitting up can leave you out of breath. Cognitively, there's a dramatic decline. For example, if you're asked to think of words starting with the letter T, you may only think of one or two. If that's not enough, it can also lead to hallucinations of seeing imaginary friends or strange behavior like taking off clothes in the death zone. Besides all that, there's still logistical dangers. There is a small window every year called climbing season to climb Everest. With the increase of climbers every year, there's often traffic jams, and these traffic jams can happen in the death zone. The traffic jams are made even more dangerous since commercialization has lowered the bar for climbing skill and experience.
Groups of amateur climbers had paid guides to take them up Mount Everest.
In 2019, 381 permits were granted for the standard route. Add the necessary Sherpas and a number of climbers doubles. Traffic jams, novice climbers, and the physical toll of oxygen deprivation not only kill you on the way up, but on the way down.
The descent is always the most dangerous and difficult part.
Getting to the summit is sometimes seen as the goal, and some climbers forget to pace themselves and their supplies and keep track of time to account for the trip back down. Sitting down to take a rest can lead to never getting back up, as delirium and exhaustion result in losing track of time and eventually death. A successful summit on Everest usually consists of a few minutes of catching your breath, taking a few pictures, and heading straight back down. Since time is so crucial, the dead are left on the mountain. It's actually more dangerous to try to remove a body, and it can lead to even more death. Often, deaths are confirmed by climbers in different seasons passing by the bodies and looking for identifying features. Let's say your body's held up and traffic's minimal. There's still one more element that you can't control, and that's the weather. The weather on Everest is probably the most dangerous variable for the climbing season. Avalanches are a common cause of mass death. In 2015 and 2016, avalanches killed 12 and 16 Sherpas. If climbers don't succumb to avalanches, there are the many ice walls and crevices that are continually moving and opening. Climbers have died from falling into the crevices or being crushed by falling sections of the ice wall. Then there's the wind. There's a jet stream which sits at the top of Everest year-round.
The 80 to 100 knot winds, the temperature was probably down to about minus 40, and visibility was now 4 or 5 meters.
This means when you get into the danger zone, you're also dealing with Category 2 hurricane strength winds, non-stop. Imagine walking into the wind in a hurricane, in the freezing cold, drunk and completely out of breath. Oh, and you're racing a clock.
From out of nowhere, a fierce blizzard swept in.
Into the book, Into Thin Air, there's a haunting story of a climber who is incapacitated in their own tent, barely alive, and their tent is knocked loose by the winds, causing him to almost suffocate against the fabric. He tried screaming for hours, but he couldn't be heard over the sound of the wind.
8 perished, and there was terrible suffering.
All right, you've survived all of that. You've made it to the top of Everest and made it home safe. We're not done. There's long-lasting effects of climbing Everest. There's the obvious physical problems of significant loss of muscle mass. There's also the very real possibility of frostbite, leading to lost fingers, toes, and more extremely, your nose or full limb. Mentally, a depression post-climb is pretty common. The physical and mental toll of an extreme experience leaves climbers exhausted and empty. This is exasperated if climbers were forced to turn back. For high-achieving personality types, it can be devastating. Losing someone on a team, especially for guides and Sherpas, leads to a significant feeling of guilt. For Sherpas, it has a negative cultural and economic effect as well. So let's get to the main question. Why do people climb Everest?
It's hard for us to understand the mindset of climbers who want to do this.
The most famous answer? Because it's there. That was said by the British climber George Leigh Mallory in 1924 before his death trying to climb it. Looking at the history of exploration, if we know something exists, we want to see it with our own eyes.
Now, you paid, I believe, $100,000 to be part of this expedition.
Not quite, but close, yes.
There's also the obvious status and prestige for people who are already predisposed to risky behavior. For many, like it was for me, Everest is mystical, and we're drawn to it. For those who climb it, it represents the ultimate experience, or pinnacle climb. There's simply nothing higher. Climbers concede that there are more beautiful mountains, more difficult mountains, more interesting mountains, but Everest is the trophy. While Sherpas may feel the same way, for them it's economical. They can charge a higher rate if they can climb to the top successfully. A sort of strange thing happens as people die every year. Everest's mystique only grows. There's no one answer, and to the 99.9% of us who will never climb Everest, there's no reasonable one. I can say, though, through reading Into Thin Air and putting together this episode, I have rekindled my childhood fascination with Everest. I've asked myself, knowing everything I know now, would I ever climb Everest? My wife asked me that popular question, if I would do it for $1 million. Like I said at the beginning, I am drawn to pushing myself physically, and that part of me does want to try climbing. But 1 out of 25 climbers don't survive. I don't know if I'd be the unlucky one. I just know I don't want to find out. Hey, listen, I want you to know that your time is valuable to me, and the fact that you spent it listening means a lot, so thank you. Please remember to subscribe wherever you listen, and maybe tell a friend or two. If you've tried this hobby or you have hobby ideas for me, let me know on Twitter or Instagram. See you next week.